today I will discuss mainly the general problem of the renormalization of non-abelian gauge theory. So since I have only two lectures left, I will not discuss any detail on the calculation. I will not do any calculation of a real diagram and show where the divergences are, because I won't have time. It would take at least two or three lectures, and I want to discuss something interesting tomorrow. But I will try to give you the general idea, and I refer you, for instance, to the book by Michael Peskin, when all the details are worked out very, very carefully, well, as they are in many, many books, especially for the case of abelian gauge theory, where it's well known since many, many years. Okay, so, but before that, I want to come back to one question that I've been asked at the end of the last lecture, which is how one can recover the SU2 symmetry out of the U2 gauge symmetry, because I have shown you that you can see how the charges are carried, of the theory as carried by the propagator, and therefore are carried by the fields in an easy way when you deal with this U2 gauge theory. So last time we were discussing a theory with a U2 symmetry, which means that the A mu, the gauge fields, are in fact 2 by 2 complex Hermitian matrices. Okay, and the Dirac fields, psi I, the psi and the psi bar, are 2 component vector, complex vector fields. Vector in the sense that there are two components spinors. And the same for the ghosts. The ghost and the anti-ghost are also 2 by 2 matrices. Okay. And we have seen that when I wrote the action for such a term, the action had two terms. First, I had this term, and then I had the gauge fixing term, which was trace of d mu and mu squared. Then there was 1/2 of psi r I. Psi. And then there was a ghost, fixing term, which was, if I am right, minus d mu, and that's it. So, well, of course, there was a trace, if you want to be precise. This is a trace, because C is a matrix. C, this is an operator which is, in fact, a matrix valued in the space of 2 by 2 Hermitian matrix, because there is a covariant derivative here. While here psi is a spinor, is a vector, and psi bar is a vector, so this is a matrix, a 2 by 2, an operator which is, in fact, a 2 by 2 matrix whose elements are operator. And then you take the scalar product with a vector and a vector, and this is a way to write the gauge fixing condition, and this is the ordinary Young-Mills term of the Lagrangian. Okay, and when I wrote that for 2 by 2 Hermitian matrices, I cheated a little bit. There is another term which is compatible with the U2 symmetry of the theory. And of course, I'm sorry, here there is a Kuplik constant, which is the usual Kuplik constant of the Young-Mills theory. And in fact, this G is the charge, gives you the charge of the various particles, of all the contents of the fields. Okay. So all the charge of the fields, the charge of the gauge fields, the charges of the fermions and the anti-fermions, the charge carried out by the Gauss field are all everywhere proportional, are always proportional to G. They may be half G to G depending on the representation of the matter field. If the matter fields are more complicated than just Dirac fermions, the charge may be multiple of this G, but they are proportional to this charge. So this is the charge. Okay, so now there is another term which I can write, which is compatible, which is with the U2 symmetry, which is a new term, which is trace of F mu nu squared. So I can add something which is minus 1 over 4 with a new coupling constant, let us call it U, trace of F mu nu squared. And you see that for if the A's are not traceless, F mu nu is a matrix which is not traceless, and therefore the trace may not be zero. So, and if you impose the, you enforce the constraint that the trace of F mu nu is equal to zero, in fact, you are enforcing the constraint that the trace of A is equal to zero up to a gauge transformation, and therefore that you reduce the gauge group from U2 to SU2. So in fact, taking the limit U goes to infinity, reduce the symmetry of the gauge theory from U2 to SU2, which we're interested in. So what does it mean in terms of the propagator? Remember that we had a propagator, so the propagator for the propagator for the gauge field, for the A mu's, had a structure like that. We show that we could write the propagator as, in fact, carrying two indices. So, this was a double colored line, if you want. It's a typical propagator has things like that. It carries two colors. One color, for instance, here are two different colors. One is going in that way and one in that way because it's Hermitian matrices. So any gauge field, in fact, which propagates, carry one color and its anticolor, if you want. And then the charges may be, so the colors, the quantum numbers may be exchanged between during the interaction. Okay. But now, what does these terms mean? If you had these terms, it means simply that you change a little bit the propagator, because in addition to a term like that, you may have a term like that in the propagator. I draw a picture, but you can write it in terms of, without any problem, in terms of indices. So it means that in addition to this term, you have the propagator is given by this term minus a new term which is present only if the color and the anticolor of the gauge field are the same. Remember that the AMU in this are labeled by AMU are labeled by two indices, two color indices, IG are equal to 1 or 2. Okay, so those are the indices of the which labels the generator of the group U2. Okay, and you see that this means simply that in addition to having a term like delta I L bar delta G bar K in the coefficient in front of the propagator, I have a new term with some coefficient, which is delta I G bar delta G K bar. If I have here, I'm studying the propagation of a gauge field which carries those quantum numbers. Okay. Pardon?
Second delta on the right should be delta K bar.
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. And with the coefficient here, and the coefficient here, if I am right, is simply, it is proportional to g squared, the original complete constant, times u squared plus 2 g squared. G squared, if you compute it correctly. You just have to invert the term. But it doesn't, so this term changes a little bit the propagator of the gauge field, but it doesn't change the interaction term. No change for the interactions. Okay? Yes? This is a trace here with respect to the 2 by 2 in the space, 2 by 2. And in addition, you are taking the sum over the mu and the nu indices elsewhere. So this, I should rewrite this as trace of f mu nu, trace of f mu nu. Okay. So first, I take the trace here. I take the trace of this element, and then I sum over the mu and nu's. So this means that each element of the f mu nu tensor, which is a trace of the 2 by 2 tensor, is zero. And from that, you can get out. You can obtain the fact that the a mu then stands for traces. It's a bit of algebra. I don't want to spend too much time on that, but you can check. But you can also see it here. So you see, there are no change for the interaction. So simply, this means that here that you see that if the I and the G are the same, the propagation of the gauge field is different. So you see. So basically, it means that for the diagonal part of the gauge field, it propagates differently. And when u goes to infinity, I'm sorry. This was a, no, there is a u here. I'm sorry, something like that.
Is it really u goes to infinity?
Sorry?
Is it definitely u goes to infinity?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. There is a 1 over u and a 1 over g squared and a g, 1 over g. I'm sorry. So basically what happens is that when u goes to infinity, this term goes to 1/2. This term becomes finite when u goes to infinity. This term goes to 1/2. And in that case, you see that this new tensor, if you contract two of the indices I and G, you get a traceless tensor. So basically, when u goes to infinity, indeed, you project out the diagonal part proportional to delta IG of the A mu IG. So basically, that's what I was stating here. U2 is, of course, xU2 plus U1. But taking the limit u goes to infinity makes this gauge field not propagating anymore. And that's it. So you can recover, in fact, to see that what I have been explaining for the U2 theory is, in fact, valid for the SU2 theory. And you see also something important, that in fact, if the gauge hook here is not simple, namely if the gauge hook can be broken into two independent components, then you may associate one coupling constant to each part. So here the U2 group has two simple components, and therefore there are two independent coupling constants. One which is associated to the charge carried out by the SU2 part of the group, and one which is the charge associated to the U1 part of the group. Okay. Yes?
So later when we want to transform this back to electroweak,
yes,
are we going to
So now we just remove the U1, and then we're going to add another U1 to him?
I'm not discussing anything about electroweak, right? Purpose is to explain. So in electroweak, it's a bit more complicated because you have chiral fermions, Yukawa coupling, etc. But some sort of. But you can, I think you can play with that. I think with it. Yeah. Well, ask Michael Peskin, I would say, because I'm not sure I will give an answer which will be completely correct. I have not in mind to take this model just by saying this is the gauge theory you have to start from for any model building. It was an example. Okay. So now let us go to the renormalization. Okay. So, remember the rule. So we had a propagator for the gauge field which carries so the gauge field carries mu indices and carry gauge group indices, but basically this is something like some group factor times the propagator p mu nu for the p. So if the momentum p is the momentum carried out by the gauge field, where this is the momentum for the Maxwell field. So basically something 1 over p times 1 plus 1 minus gauge fixing term p mu p nu over p squared. Remember, this is typical. There are some I factor and there is some symmetry factor. Oh, here there is a delta, an eta mu nu, of course. Eta mu nu is the metric of the metric of spacetime. But you see that basically the propagator of the gauge field behaves like 1 over p squared. Okay? The propagator, so this is for the gauge field. For the fermion field, the propagator for a fermion, so this is a gauge, A mu, this is a psi. The propagator for the fermion field is the propagator for a Dirac field, delta of p. So it behaves, it's 1 over p slash minus m or plus m. Don't remember what. So basically, it behaves like 1 over p at large distances. Then you have Dirac indices, symmetry indices, but this behaves like 1 over p squared. This behaves like 1 over p. And we have the propagator for the ghost field, okay, which behaves, so we have the propagator, let us say write this g for the ghosts, which behaves also like 1 over p squared. We have seen that the propagator for the gauge field, for the ghost field, is just the same propagator of the propagator for the scalar particle. Simply, you have to remember that the ghost is a fermion. Therefore, when you will compute diagrams, you have to take into account the minus 1 sign when you commute, when you change the position of C and C bars. When taking expectation values, you get minus signs, exactly for the same thing after the Dirac field. Okay. So the rules for computing the propagator of the gauge field are those of the scalar field. But when you look at the symmetry factor, the traces, etc., you have to apply the rules of the Dirac field. Okay. So this is a ghost, C and C bar. This is the rules for psi and psi bar, the propagator between psi and psi bar. And we have the interaction terms, which basically we have the interaction for the bosons. We have the interaction for the fermion term, and we have the interaction for the ghost, so for the ghost field. Okay. And we have seen that the vertex for the interaction between three gauge fields carries a p momentum. So this vertex carries a p, because there is a p mu somewhere. There is a p mu delta nu rho. If you have mu nu rho, there is somewhere, in fact, there was a p minus q mu nu rho, which means that if you consider what is the term associated to the index, the Lorentz index mu for one incoming gauge boson, you have to contract the polarization of this incoming gauge boson with the difference between the momenta coming here and here. Okay. But basically, this means that you have a factor of P of one of the incoming momenta carried on this vertex. Here you have nothing because you have products of delta of delta mu nu, and you have symmetry factors coming from the Casimirs, from the structure factor of the group. But this behaves like one. Okay. The same for the in terms of momenta. The same. The vertex interaction between the fermions and the gauge field, it contains a gamma mu nu, but it's over the one. While the vertex interaction between the ghost, this is the ghost, it contained a P. It contained a P, a factor of P mu, because it has to be contracted. One, the momenta of the outcoming ghost field had to be contracted with the polarization of the incoming gauge boson. So basically, this behaves like P as a function of the momenta. Okay, so there are complicated symmetry factors associated to the real symmetry structure of the gauge series. But as far as naive renormalization analysis, when we shall look at where are located, whether there are short distance divergence, so high energy singularities in the theory, you have just to remember at the first step that this is how it behaves at in high momentum, the different part of the of the diagram. Okay. So now, what we have to do is. To study the different kind of diagrams, so to try, we have to try to play, to start to play the same game that we did for the scalar field theory. So looking at what are the divergence, where are at one loop the divergence of the theory. So where are the ultraviolet singularities? The theory. Okay, so let us start first by looking at the propagator of the Fermi field, so of the Dirac field. So let us see. We are interested in how behave at one loop an irreducible function. So we look at an irreducible diagram, where we have one Fermi field incoming, so one fermion incoming and one fermion outcoming. So this is just the propagator, called the propagator of the fermion. Okay. Then we have also, of course, the first term at three level is just the Dirac propagator. But then you have a correction, and the first diagram which it comes is you have no choice. If I'm looking at how can I create a one loop diagram, I have only possible diagram which is because the fermions can only emit or interact with one gauge field and reabsorb it. So this is the only diagram which is present in the theory. Okay. And let us not look at the exact value of this diagram, in particular all the Dirac, how the Dirac indices and how the gauge field indices are distributed. But basically, if you want to compute these amplitudes, here you see that somewhere here there is an internal momentum. So if this is the internal momentum, the incoming momentum of the fermion, by the Feynman rules, if the
if the gluon or the gauge field is carrying an internal momentum q, the fermion here carries an internal momentum p plus q. This is a four momentum. And therefore, when you integrate over the momenta to compute the amplitude for this Feynman diagram, you get an integral which is behaves like you have something which is the first approximation, d4q. You have a 1 over q squared. And you have a 1 over p plus q slash plus m. And then some complicated factors coming from taking into account the gauge field indices, the Dirac indices, and taking the appropriate trace over everything which has to be traced. Okay. But that's basically how this diagram behaves. And you see that this diagram behaves in large momentum. It has a linear divergence because this behaves like 1 over q squared. And this behaves like this is an integral which is proper to q4. So there is a linear divergence in this diagram. When if you assume that, for instance, that q is less than lambda, some large cutoff, and if you want to compute this diagram, you found that there is a linear divergence, so it has to be, you expect that it will be proportional to lambda. Okay? So you expect that this diagram will be proportional to lambda, and then you expect that there will be some log lambda coefficient in addition. And the log lambda terms have to be proportional to something which is as a dimension of a momentum. And the only available things you have in this momenta are p slash, in fact, plus m times log lambda. So basically, if you compute this propagator corresponding to this diagram, you expect that it will be, it can be proportional, there will be a term proportional to lambda, the ultraviolet regulator, and then there will be subdominant terms which are proportional to log of lambda, and there are two terms which, two divergences which may occur, a divergence proportional to m, and a divergence proportional to the incoming momentum p slash. Okay, and then you have some coefficient in front of that you have to compute. Okay, so, okay, and the rule of the game is to compute those coefficients. But Lorentz invariance impose that you can only have those terms. You see, Lorentz invariance impose that you cannot have more complicated combination or non-symmetric combination of those. Okay? Now, we have seen that these terms and these terms are supposed to correspond to a normalization of the mass. Of the mass. Because they correspond, you remember, we had here this is a Lagrangian for the Fermi field. And if you have a divergence which is proportional to a constant here, this means that you have to add a counter term, which is a delta m times psi bar psi. So these terms should correspond to a counter term of the mass counter terms. Okay. And these terms, in fact, if you have a divergence which is proportional to p squared, it means that, in fact, well, remember, p slash is a Fourier transform of the operator this I d slash. So this means that you have, in addition, to have a counter terms delta, let us say, z, times psi bar I d slash psi. So you have to add in the action a term which is proportional to the kinetic term for the Fermi field. So this is called, in fact, field
for normalization. Simply because if you add a counter term which is proportional psi bar psi, you can always rescale psi so that this disappears. So you can define, instead of writing 1 plus delta z psi bar I d slash psi, these terms, you can always redefine change psi prime by saying that psi is equal to square root of 1 plus delta z, some new psi renormalized. So that these terms become psi bar renormalized, I d slash psi renormalized. So it's equivalent to say that I had a counter term proportional to psi bar d slash psi, or to state that I am redefining, I am renormalizing, I'm just changing the normalization of my field operator. It's an operator, and I am free to define it. What's important is that S-matrix elements in the theory are finite. They are defined from some correlation function, but that's an intermediate step. You are integrating over this field, if you prefer, in the functional integral. So this corresponds to making a change of variables in the functional integral. Okay. Good. So we compute this, and it's a diagram which, in addition, is in fact independent of the fact that the theory is abelian or non-abelian, because the factor will depend on the symmetry group, but the structure of the diagram is independent of the fact that the gauge group is abelian or non-abelian, because the propagator here is just the propagator of the photon. Okay, so it's a diagram which is already present in quantum electrodynamics. Okay, so now you may ask, if you compute, and this was done in the 40s and the 50s, this kind of diagram, you discover that the lambda term is absent. Lambda, the lambda term, the lambda divergence is absent. Okay? This means that if the mass of the Fermi field is zero, it is not renormalized. So that's different from the case of a scalar field that we have been discussing last week. Remember, in last week, we discussed the renormalization of the interacting scalar field phi, and we saw that in order to have a physical mass or renormalized mass to be equal to zero, we had to add a renormalization of the mass, so of the phi. So we had we needed to have a counter term of the form lambda squared phi squared. You see, in the case of a Fermi field coupled to a gauge field, in fact, you don't need to have a term proportional to lambda times psi bar psi. Why is it so? It is so because, in fact, of a symmetry. Because of a symmetry of the theory when m is equal to zero, the mass of the Fermi. In general, if you found that some divergence is not absent, it's because there is some symmetry which protects in the amplitude, which protects the theory from the appearance of short distance divergence. And that's one very, very important recipe in the building of models, because when you have problem with the ultraviolet divergence of the theory, we physicists are looking for a symmetry principle. We try to introduce a symmetry principle to prevent this from happening. And for instance, one very well-known example, it didn't work out finally, but when people were trying to avoid the problem of having a vacuum energy which is infinite, they introduced supersymmetry. Well, it was not the only reason for introducing supersymmetry, but supersymmetry, rigid supersymmetry, having boson and Fermi fields with some symmetry between them, protects theory from getting a vacuum energy which is infinite. So that's a typical example of a case where a symmetry forbids the appearance of some divergence. So what is the symmetry associated to the disappearance of this lambda term when the mass is equal to zero? Or when the it is that it is a symmetry which is called the axial symmetry. It's related to an axial symmetry, which is, and the axial symmetry is something very important in high energy physics because it's associated to the fact that when you have massless fermions, no, the neutrino, if the neutrino would, had not a mass, now we know that the neutrino have a mass, but for a long time, most theoreticians thought that the neutrino had no mass, and there would be massless fermion. And if you have a massless fermion, it propagates at the speed of light. So C, so the speed is equal to the speed of light. And the fermion has a spin, so it can have two possible independent states for the spin. And if the particle goes at the speed of light, the spin can be either like that. The spin can be oriented along the speed or on the other side. So when you're speaking of a fermion with the right helicity, right or left. I never remember which is right and which is left, but basically, in the case of massless fermion, you can separate the fermions into two kinds of fermions, right fermions and left fermions. Okay, and in fact, this in the free theory, if there is no interaction with the electromagnetic field, those fermions do not see each other. They don't interact. They don't mix. There is no mixing between the right moving and the left moving, the right fermions and the left fermions. You know, if you start from a state, I think, yes?
So we can think of a mass as an interaction term between the left and the right
moving? No, we can think of the mass as a mixing term, which makes that you have two states with a You have two quantum states with the same energy, and simply when there is a mass, there is the Hamiltonian mixes those two states, so they rotate. You know, it's a pure right a state which is a pure right moving fermion as time goes on become a superposition of a right moving fermions and the left moving fermions, and then it becomes a left fermion, and then it becomes again a right fermion. So you have just a rotation in the Hilbert space. Okay. So it's not really an interaction. It's just that you have not chosen the right base for the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay. But so there is an axial symmetry, and in that case, the symmetry is simply that. How can you realize this symmetry in the theory? Well, it's simple. It is simply that, remember, if you have the gamma 5 matrix in the Dirac holology, which is I think gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma, well, there is a gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. So you have a gamma 5 matrix. And if you work out the Dirac holology, you discover that under the symmetry where you change psi into I gamma 5 psi and psi bar into minus I gamma 5 psi, so it's a discrete symmetry here. This amounts to change the wave function for a right fermions into plus and to I, and to change the wave function of a left fermion by a factor minus I. Okay, then you discover that the term of I d slash psi psi bar is conserved. It's just a simple exercise of Dirac holography, while the mass term psi bar psi goes to minus m psi by psi. Okay, so you see that there is a symmetry in the theory, a very simple discrete symmetry, which is realized in the theory only if the mass is equal to zero. Okay, and it is this discrete symmetry which protects the mass from being renormalized if we start from a mass which is equal to zero. Okay. So here I have this is a discrete, in fact, I have a discrete part of the axial symmetry. But I won't discuss that more.
In the second term.
Yes.
Would it be psi bar?
Oh, I'm sorry, there is a plus. I'm sorry, there is a plus I here because I'm very sorry. Psi and psi bar behaves in the same way. And in fact, psi bar, yeah, I am sorry. Psi bar is, and psi bar should be on the other side. I'm sorry, because psi bar, if you want, is a covector. So this is the correct. Okay. And since gamma 5 is equal to 1, but gamma 5, gamma mu is equal to minus gamma mu, gamma 5, pardon? Gamma 5 squared is 1. You can work out very easily that this term is preserved. Why is this term change of sign? Okay. So in fact, the theory seems to have a more general kind of axial symmetries, which is that if you change psi into e to the I alpha gamma 5 psi and psi bar into psi bar e to the I alpha gamma 5 with alpha a real parameter, if you want. Okay. In fact, the Dirac equation is invariant under this global symmetry because this is now a U1 symmetry. And in fact, the theory, the Dirac equation, is invariant for massless fermions. For massless fermions, the theory is invariant under this continuous U1 symmetry, which is called the axial U1 symmetry. So you see, massless fermions, if they don't interact with the gauge field, have an additional symmetry, which is called the axial U1 symmetry, which is only there if the fermions are massless. Okay. And in fact, there is a whole story about this axial symmetry because it plays a very important role in high energy physics and in quantum field theory because this symmetry has an anomaly when there is a coupling with gauge field in general. Exactly like, remember, we studied in the case of the 5-4 theory, the classical theory had a scale invariance, and this scale invariance was spoiled by the quantum effect. And in fact, this U1 symmetry, which is a symmetry of the classical theory, is also spoiled by quantum effect when the fermions are coupled to gauge field. So you must be aware of that, but I'm sure that Michael Peskin will discuss that a lot because that's one of the very important features in building theories of gauge interaction. Okay? So what remains of this symmetry, which is broken in general, is in fact what's happening when alpha is equal to pi over 2. Because when alpha is equal to pi over 2, you can check that this symmetry becomes the discrete symmetry here. So you see, so you start from an axial symmetry, which is supposed to be valid for you are performing rotation in proportion of alpha, and in fact, what remains is just a symmetry when you make rotation, discrete rotation like that, under this kind of rotation. Yes?
So the axial symmetry, under what condition is it there?
Is it there?
Like, what are the conditions for the Lagrangian to have that global continuous axial symmetry?
You mean the classical Lagrangian? The fermions must be massless.
And that's it.
And that's it. If you have Dirac fermions, the fermions will be massless. And in that case, you can separate, you can find the basis for the Dirac fermions into the Dirac fermions. The Dirac fermions lives in four states. Spinors are four states. And you can separate these states into two states with two component fermions. The left fermions, which are two component chiral fermions, and the right fermions, which are two component chiral fermions. And there is a symmetry between those two.
And the quantum corrections break that continuous axial symmetry to the discrete, it seems.
Yeah, they do not really break. They spoil out. The symmetry is not there anymore, except for this case.
I'm going
very slowly. But that's an important. You must be aware of this existence of axial symmetries and the fact that there are anomalies in a quantum theory. That's very important. But I won't elaborate more. I would need a whole lecture to discuss axial symmetries and anomalies, axial anomalies. Okay. So now let us go back to renormalization of gauge theory. So we have seen that for the part which concerns just the kinetic part of the fermions, there is a mass renormalization for the fermions, which is proportional to some logarithm. So you need a quantum term. There will be a renormalization of the field of the fermions because of this p/slash term. And this term here is not there. So if the mass of if the fermions are massless, they remain massless in the quantum theory. Okay. Now, let us go back to the same game for the interaction vertex between the gauge field. So I have a gauge field here, a mu, a psi, and a psi dagger. Okay. This term is also simple because there is only one diagram at one loop which can be present, which is a diagram like that. Yes. It is like that. You may have that's a bit more complicated. Here you have two kinds of diagrams. First, you have a diagram which I draw like that. Which corresponds to the following process. You have your fermion which emits a virtual gauge field. While this virtual gauge field propagates in the vacuum, it interacts with an incoming gauge field, and then it reabsorbs the virtual gauge field. Okay, so that's one of the possible processes. And then there is another process. Remember that in the gauge theory, there is a three-vertex interaction for the gauge field. So the gauge field may transmute itself into two gauge fields, and then these two gauge fields interact. Okay, so these are the two possible diagrams for the vertex interaction between gauge field and the fermion. Okay, now let us do the power counting. Remember, in this diagram, we have a momentum, so we have an incoming momentum P, we have an incoming momentum P prime, and here we have a momentum Q. So how does this diagram behave? There is a D4Q. There is a gluon gauge field or gluon propagator which behaves like 1/Q². And there are two Dirac propagators which behave like 1/Q. And that's it. Then you have a complicated Dirac-ology and group indices because you have an a constant structure coming from this term. So you have a constant structure term from the group coming from this term and one from this term, and you have to take traces of the corresponding indices, and you have also to take the traces for the Dirac indices. So you get something complicated. But this divergence is logarithmically divergent, you see? But the same for here, because here you have one Fermi propagator, 1 over Q. Here you have two gluon propagators, 1 over Q squared, 1 over Q squared. But remember that the gluon propagator, the gluon vertex, behave like Q. They may be a Q, a momentum, attached to this gluon propagator. So both terms gives you a log lambda. Okay? So there is a logarithmic divergence associated to this diagram. And remember that the original diagram at three levels, when you have an A mu interacting with psi psi, contains some symmetry factor associated to the FABC and A mu nu, but it contains the coupling constant G, the original coupling constant so we remember that we had typically in the Hamiltonian, in the action, we had terms which were dA with some antisymmetric indices. We had a G dA AA, and we had the term G squared AAAA. These were the terms coming from the F mu nu, the expansion of F mu nu in terms of A. So now, if you worked out all the indices, and that's something which is difficult to do, but so I won't do that, you discover that the divergence is proportional to the term here. So we need, in fact, here delta G dA AA for normalization, with the same symmetry factor than those coming from the fact that the theory here is gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant. So the non-trivial part of the calculation is to show that this divergence should be proportional to that. Okay. Because each term individually is not independent, is not of the form of this diagram. So you need to... and I forgot something very important. That's okay, that's all. Okay. Now, let us look at the other diagrams. So the third diagram, which is important, is I'm sorry, I'm saying something completely stupid. This renormalization is a renormalization of the psi psi a mu. So in fact, here I have what I have constructed is a counter term of the form psi bar a psi. I'm sorry, for the moment, this is completely untrue. What I've constructed is a renormalization of the terms which describe the interaction between the gauge field and the fermion. And this is the term which comes from the fact that here I had to take not the ordinary derivative with respect to the, but the covariant derivative, because d slash, remember, is d slash minus ig a slash. Okay? So in fact, I have renormalized with a term proportional to the coupling constant, the term of interaction between the fermions and the gauge field. And this term, the result of the calculation, is that the counter term here has the form of ig gamma mu a mu, which was not obvious in the beginning, because this psi contains, this psi carries an index I, this psi carries an index g, this term carries an alpha equal I g bar index, and this psi and this the incoming and the outcoming term carries Dirac indices. So you have to check that the divergence has indeed the correct structure in terms of the Dirac indices, the group indices, and the Lorentz indices. which is not obvious. Okay. So now let us look at the propagator of the gauge field. Okay, if you look at the propagator of the gauge field, the original propagator, we have seen what it is a propagator of the same as the propagator of the photon, well, times the symmetry factor coming from the fact that they carry some quantum number associated to the gauge symmetry. Now, what are the corrections to the gauge field? There are three diagrams. You have a diagram which is a very well-known diagram in quantum electrodynamics, where the gauge field can create, so the electromagnetic field, if you want, the gauge field create a pair of a fermion and its antifermion. Those fermions propagate, and then they annihilate and they emit a gauge field. So this is a well-known diagram, which is called the vacuum polarization. Vacuum polarization diagram in quantum electrodynamics. This process is true, it exists in quantum electrodynamics, but it exists in any theory with a fermions coupled to the gauge field. Okay? But now remember that in general, for a non-abelian gauge field, we have also a process where the gauge field may become two gauge field because we have three vertex. Those gauge field propagates and end up. And they become another gauge field. So we have this diagram. And in addition, remember we have the gauge field may interact with itself. So we have a diagram like that, which is like the tadpole of the 5-4 theory. And in addition, we have the ghosts. So the gauge field may create a pair of one ghost and one anti-ghost. Those one propagates and become a gauge field again. So this is, we create a pair of fermions. Here we create a pair of gauge field. Here the gauge field interacts with itself. And here the gauge field creates ghosts. Okay, so this is a fermion loop, if you want. This is a gauge field loop, and this is a ghost loop. Okay. So now, two important things has to be said about this diagram, because these diagrams starts to the physics of non-abelian gauge field are contained in those terms and those terms which are new with respect to what's happening in quantum electrodynamics, abelian gauge field. First, let us do the power counting. Okay. This diagram behaves like, so we have now a momentum going around. Well, this diagram is not very important at that stage. So in the integral, we always was the D4Q, and what do we have here? We have a fermion propagator, so we have a 1 over Q times a 1 over Q. Okay, so this seemingly will give us a lambda squared, and then we may have a term of P squared if P is a momentum incoming, log lambda. Okay. Pardon? And we may have the fermion mass too. Yes. Okay. Well, now, in fact, if you do the calculation, you discover that this term and this term are absent because of gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetry in quantum electrodynamics. Gauge symmetries enforce, at least in U1, enforce that these terms are not present, because otherwise it would mean that the quantum fluctuation would give a mass to the photon and the photon has no mass because of gauge symmetry. So it remains this factor. And this factor, in fact, those photons carry mu nu, so Lorentz indices. And you discover that, in fact, what you have here is a p is a term which is proportional to p nu minus g mu nu eta mu nu p mu p nu p squared, which is the form required for having gauge invariance. Okay, so we expect to have a renormalization of this coefficient. Okay. So now let us look at this coefficient. This coefficient behaves also like, now we have a 1 over p squared, a 1 over q squared, a 1 over q squared. We may have a q here, we may have a q here. So it has the same structure. We may have a divergence proportional to the some mass and the divergence proportional to p squared. Okay? Here we have same phenomenon. This can be a term proportional to the mass. And finally, for the ghosts, that's the same thing. We may have a term proportional to, here we have a 1 over q squared. Here we have a 1 over q squared. But we have a q coming from the gauge vertex. And we have a q coming from the gauge vertex. So in fact, this is this rule, sum of four diagrams, four kinds of diagrams, which behave like that. Okay? And we may, and when one does the calculation in a proper way, one checks that in fact only a term proportional to these terms plus the zeta dA squared term, so the 1 over zeta. Remember, we had a term like that. These terms come from the Maxwell interaction, and these terms comes from the gauge fixing, that these terms get renormalized in this way with some coefficient. So we have a, now we have a coefficient which is of the form delta delta g times dA squared with the correct form. Okay? So what we have found, we have found that by considering this diagram, the diagram of the propagation of one fermion, the renormalization of the mass of the fermion, we have seen that the mass, the fermion mass is renormalized, the wave function of the fermion is renormalized, and the coupling constant of the gauge field of the, well, and there is a renormalization of the dA squared term. Okay. Now one has to check that when one, we shall consider now the vertices corresponding to the interaction of three gauge field and the interaction of four gauge field, and when we shall consider the term corresponding to the propagation of the ghost and the propagation of the interaction between the ghost and the anti and the gauge field, we have new vertices, new kind of diagrams that have to be considered here. So we may have now finally, we must consider the diagram which occurs when you have three gluon field, and then it starts to become very complicated because gauge field may interact by creating a loop of gauge field. They may interact by in such a process where a gauge field becomes three gauge field, which then annihilates to become two gauge field. We may have something like that, where we have, this is a one loop diagram. Of course, the three gauge field may interact via a loop of fermions. And finally, we have the ghost. So the three fermions may interact via a loop with ghosts. Okay, and it starts to become very, very complicated once you take into account all the possible symmetry factor and group factor in the diagrams. It becomes really a mess. Okay, and the question is, does these diagrams amount to having a log lambda divergence proportional to the correct dA times A times A interaction terms given by gauge invariance? Okay, and if this term will give you a renormalization of the coupling constant. But if the renormalization of the coupling constant is not consistent with the renormalization of the coupling constant given by this diagram, gauge invariance is lost. You see, because of gauge invariance, the coupling constant between fermions and gauge field is related to the coupling constant describing the interaction between three gauge fields. It's fixed by gauge invariance. Because it's in both cases, it is given by how, in the covariant derivative, d mu enters the gauge field. Okay? Now, let us continue. And finally, we have this kind of diagrams. We may be interested in what's happening when we have four fermions interacting, and four fermions interacting will be given by also many complicated diagrams. We will have a diagram where the four fermions interact by four bosons, some four vector fields interact via an internal loop of fermions, an internal loops of ghosts. Hop, an internal loop of gauge field. Okay. And among the internal loop of gauge field, you may have, in fact, this may happen. Because remember that you have vertex which describes the interaction with three gauge field and vertices which describes the interaction between four gauge field. So you have this kind of diagram, and you have this kind of diagram, if I am right. Okay, so if you want to study this in terms of Feynman diagram, this becomes quite involved. Okay. And now if you do the power counting interaction, you see that, for instance, this behaves like 1 over Q. There is a 1 over Q per fermion propagator, 1 over Q, 1 over Q, 1 over Q, 1 over Q. So this is logarithmically divergent. Okay. Same for ghosts. We have a 1 over Q squared, 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 but you have a Q, 1 Q, 1 Q. So this behaves like 1 over Q4. So this gives a logarithmic divergence. The same for this boson, the same for this, the same for this. So this gives an interaction, a divergence which is proportional to log the lambda times a product of four boson fields. And so we expect, and of course there will be G squared terms. So this will be, in fact, will give a counter term proportional to G to the 4 A. So we'll have a counter term. And one has to check that this counter term is the form and the value of the counter term is consistent with the counter term from this interaction term and from the counter term for this interaction term in order to respect gauge invariance. Otherwise, gauge invariance is spoiled. And finally, we have to look at the ghosts, because the ghosts are essential for the consistency of the theory. So we have to look at the diagram for the ghost, and that's always the same game. we have a diagram like that. When a ghost emits a gauge field and then reabsorbs the gauge field. And we have to look at the consistency of the vertex interaction between the ghosts and the gauge field. And here, that's the same. We have the same kind of diagram that here. We have a gauge. The ghost may propagate like that with a gauge field. Like that, and we may have a diagram like that. So those are the same diagram between the ghosts and the than for the fermions. Okay. Okay. So you see the calculation of if you want to do an explicit calculation, that's what has been done at first. To compute the renormalizability of gauge field, you have to take into account a large number of diagrams and a large number of symmetry factors. And this is done in the book by Preskin, I think, in many books. Okay. So now, another important issue I want to discuss now before the end is that what happens in such calculation about the unphysical state. You know, what about the unphysical state? Unphysical states. Remember that we have two kinds of unphysical state in our theory. We have the longitudinal polarization modes for the gauge field. Because those have, for instance, negative norm states. And we have the ghosts plus anti-ghosts, which have to be there in order to ensure the gauge invariance of the theory, but which are unphysical states in the sense that, for instance, they are negative norm states. They don't obey the Fermi the spin statistic theorem. Okay, and the problem with those unphysical states in any calculation is that, for instance, take the calculation of the propagator of the gauge field. So if you want the polarization of the vacuum by the interaction. Having a loop of fermions here is perfectly sensible from the point of view of physics. There is no problem. Now, in this diagram, you may very well have unphysical states of the photon which propagate. So this means they are computing a probability amplitude where in some intermediate states, you have negative norm states. Okay. So you are summing over intermediate states in some quantum process, and in between, you are summing over states which have a negative norm. That's very bad for unitarity. You will expect that if you take this diagram into account, it will contribute with negative probability amplitudes in some, for instance, some S matrix elements associated to this process. So problem with unitarity. Unitarity, there is a clash with unitarity. Okay. There is also a clash with unitarity because of the intermediate states which contains ghosts and anti-ghosts. You see? So both causes problem with unitarity. Now, the nice properties, and that's why ghosts are very important in the formulation of gauge theories, is that you have to remember that ghosts are fermions. They are scalar from the point of view of the Lorentz group. They have spin zero, but they are fermions. The ghost creation and annihilation operator anti-commute instead of commuting. So in particular, this means that when you do calculation with fermions, each time that you have a loop of fermions in the calculation, you have a minus sign. Fermion loop gives a minus one sign, okay? And that's simply because, for instance, in the case of fermions, If you are computing a loop of fermions, you are computing the products of a psi and the psi dagger and the psi and the psi dagger. And when you are computing the expectation value of this object, you have to carry out the anti-commuting. You have to make the fermion and anti-creation and annihilation operator anti-commute in order to apply the Wick theorem. And when you apply the Wick theorem, you end up at the end with a minus sign. So that's because of the Wick theorem plus anti-commutation of the psi and psi bar. Okay? So you have a minus one sign which comes here from the fermions, which is something which is already present in quantum electrodynamics. You have a plus one sign associated, when you do the calculation, associated to these internal loops of gauge field. And you have a minus one sign associated to this internal loop of Gauss. And when you do the calculation, you discover that the contribution of unphysical states to this, in this diagram, is cancelled out by the contribution of the unphysical states of the ghost because of the minus one sign. You see? So there is a cancellation. So this gives a cancellation between the unphysical, so the longitudinal linear vectors and the ghosts. Because the ghosts are fermions. And the results end up as being something which has the correct form, so which corresponds to a renormalization of the gauge field. It is Lorentz invariant. It is gauge invariant, and it respects unitarity. So unitarity is respected at the end because of this phenomenon of cancellation. And this phenomenon of cancellation occurs everywhere. Here you may have unphysical states which contribute. They are cancelled by the ghost, by this loop ghost. Here you may have unphysical states. Their contribution is cancelled by the ghost. And here it's exactly the same. Here you may have an unphysical state, and it's cancelled by the ghost. Well, here you have unphysical state. Well, it's not that important for the ghost because they are unphysical anyway, but still you have to check. Yes?
If you do the calculation happens exactly, or is this a power counting?
No. You have to do the calculation exactly with all the symmetry factor in order to check that the cancellation occurs. And that's something which is complicated.
Okay.
Pardon? So, pardon?
We need to do this through Wick's theorem in order to make sure we get the right negative.
You can do that, but fortunately, and I will end up with this. So now I have to end up with two important things. First, you end up with a renormalization from the coupling constant. And we end up with a beta function. But OK, first I answer to your question. So do we have to do just the calculation? No, because in fact, when people have been studying the renormalization of gauge theories, basically, they ended up in around 71 by showing that gauge theories were renormalizable at one loop. And I think the first we did the calculation correctly was Gerhard Toft, who computed the beta function for the gauge, for a non-abelian gauge field. But the story goes is a little bit complicated because he didn't publish his result. Because his advisor, well, he thought, and his advisor thought it was more important to study renormalization of gravity. And so the calculation was done a few years later by Politzer and Gross independently, and Gross and Vilcek. Okay. And who, in fact, were the first to construct a theory of strong interaction relying on non-abelian gauge field.
Okay.
But, well, Toft and did the calculation explicitly. And after that, people came out in 73, 75 by studying the properties of symmetries of the gauge theories. So looking at what are the symmetries of the gauge theories, which are important to show that the theory is renormalizable. And the most, so there are several formulations which allows by using general principle to show that the gauge theories are renormalizable without having to check by explicit calculation that this happens at one loop for this amplitude or for this amplitude. And I think the most beautiful formulation of the symmetry principle behind contained in gauge theories, which allows to prove renormalizability, is the so-called BRST symmetry. There are other formulations of the gauge theory which works as well in order to prove that the gauge theory is symmetric, is renormalizable. But the BRST symmetry is the most elegant. I think it's due to Becky, Rouet, Stora. And independently, I think it's Tuipin, I think. I'm not sure I spell his name correctly, a Russian physicist. We discovered that there is a beautiful symmetry hidden in the theory of non-abelian gauge theories with gauge fixing, which is some kind of supersymmetry, if you want, a supersymmetry, because it mixes supersymmetry, because it's there is a symmetry which mixes the gauge field and the ghost, which is something you do not expect physically. There is a symmetry which mixes the gauge and the ghost field, which is some kind of mathematical symmetry hidden in the formalism of gauge theories, which allows to prove in a very elegant way that gauge theories are renormalizable and that all those constellations and all those symmetry properties holds at all order. And I want to mention that because BRST symmetries are very important in not only in gauge theories, but in quantum gravity, in string theory, and in many, many aspects of modern theoretical physics. Yes?
So if our boson is not massless, then longitudinal state is physical. So what's going to cancel out this ghost state?
If the photon is massless?
Well, no, but if it's gauge. Like a, not a photon, a gauge. If we do another force, say the strong force.
Strong forces.
So if you have like a Z or a W or
okay, no.
A massive boson.
If you have massive bosons, it means that you have a theory which is not a gauge series coupled to Fermi field. Because if you have pure gauge theories or gauge theories coupled just to Fermi fields, you cannot have massive vector bosons. Because pure gauge field have to be gauge invariant, so the gauge field has to stay massless because of the gauge invariance. If you introduce a mass term, it is not gauge invariant. You can start to do that. This has been done for electrodynamics, but you run into problems with unitarity. So you have to stop. And if you try to, for instance, to add fermions, we have seen that, for instance, if you may try to have fermions with a mass, but the mass of the fermions will not be coupled with the mass of the gauge field because of this axial symmetry, if you want. So there is some symmetry which protects the mass of the fermions to go into giving a mass to the bosons. You see? So it's only when you have massive coupling of the gauge field to massive vector, to massive scalar particle like the X field, that you may have some mechanism of transmutation which makes the appearance of vector fields which have a mass. And that's what I wanted to discuss very briefly tomorrow. You will see that at length with Michael Peskin because it's a building block of all the modern theory of electroweak and strong interaction. Well, sometimes some people have even called the X a God particle for some marketing reason. But it's very, very important. But that's not, this mechanism doesn't happen in the framework that I've been presented here. If you have only gauge field and fermions, you can never have a massive vector boson in the spectrum of the theory because of gauge invariance.
If I had a gauge, would I kill my ghost?
Pardon? If?
Like, say we did add our Higgs particle or Lagrangian minimum.
Let us discuss a little bit the Higgs particle tomorrow, because that's another story. You don't need to see what the Higgs particle will do to the theory. You don't need to go to one loop. It's something which happens in already at the level of the classical theory. So let us discuss that tomorrow. It's more complicated. Okay.
Yeah, I would imagine.